You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades,
light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds pass right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of The Spear. My guest on this episode is Kevin Mott. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, John. Happy to be here.
So I want to kind of give a shout out to, a couple of organizations and programs. We got linked up because you were a Downing Scholar. The Downing Scholars program run by the Combating Terrorism Center, which takes Army officers from what we used to call the combat arms branches, maneuvers, fires, and effects branches, and sends them to graduate school. Our former director at MWI was also the former director at the Combating Terrorism Center, so he put you and I in touch. It's a cool program, a really good program, so I want to kind of, like I said, just give a shout out to them, and also to the Association of Graduates. The story that you're going to share with us is one that for which you were recognized as a recipient of the Nininger Award, which is an award for valor given by the Association of Graduates to a West Point graduate. AOG, the Association of Graduates, has been really supportive of MWI at various times and done a lot for us. So I want to also kind of give them a little bit of recognition. So you are an Army officer. Can you give listeners just maybe a little bit about your background, your military career?
Absolutely, John. So I was I started off my time in the Army as a platoon leader in 2nd Battalion, 327th Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team, 101st Airborne Division, so the No Slack Battalion. After that, I served as a Striker Company Commander at Fort Bliss. Then I was a Downing Scholar at Stanford, and then a field grade in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, and currently Battalion XO here at 2nd Battalion, 4th SFAB here at Fort Carson, Colorado.
And when did you commission?
So I commissioned in 2007, and so I arrived to the 101st in 2008. I became a platoon leader in the No Slack Battalion. I went with them to Samar, Iraq for just a few months, was a platoon leader there, kind of cut my teeth on leadership and deployment there, came back, and then did the full train up and deployed with them to Kunar Province, Afghanistan in really late April, early May 2010.
Okay. And the story you're going to share is from that deployment to Kunar Province. What was your job when you deployed?
So I showed up. I was the reconnaissance platoon leader, the scout platoon leader for the battalion. So, you know, I was in charge of three sniper teams, three recon teams, you know, my platoon sergeant and I. And so I guess when we kind of started out the deployment, we were really just kind of bouncing all over the place, trying to help out the companies as we kind of made contact with the enemy and figured things out. So when we first arrived, again, this would have been May 2010, things were getting pretty lethal, pretty kinetic in the area, pretty good amount of fighting. Kind of one of the things that we figured out is that when new units rotated into the area, the enemy would typically in the first 30 to 90 days would test them through some massing fighters, some larger scale attacks, some larger ambushes. So it was definitely an interesting time.
So you were in Kunar province, and most people, when they picture Afghanistan, I think from whatever they've seen on TV, they picture this kind of rugged mountains, and Kunar very much was that sort of terrain. I wonder if you can just describe, though, how you know, how difficult it was, how rugged it was, specifically in the kind of the very localized area that you were operating in.
Absolutely. So it's kind of interesting terrain. The Kunar River Valley was somewhere around, you know, 3, maybe 4,000 feet, kind of the baseline there. And then, so like the majority of the FOBs were kind of in the low ground like that, right? But as soon as you left, you're essentially completely surrounded by mountains on, you know, 3 or 4 sides. So the terrain anywhere was from, you know, FOB Joyce, where we were kind of based at, was at roughly 3,000 feet, 3,500 feet, something like that. But we would do these Bataan air assaults or air insertions up to, you know, sometimes up to 10 or even 11,000 feet. So it was essentially a river valley, right? The Kunar River Valley kind of running in the middle, but then on all sides, surrounded by mountains, it would were extremely rugged, like shale rock kind of terrain with trees. And again, would go up to, you know, as high as 10 or even 11,000 feet.
Okay. I want to kind of circle back to something you said just a minute ago, which was that the Taliban would sort of increase their activity when a new American unit would cycle into the area of operations. Can you kind of describe what that looked like in your experience?
Sure. So there were several deliberate operations that were planned in Kunar province, or really kind of that corridor, the N2KL, the region of eastern Afghanistan, on a regular basis. So farther north of Kunar province, FOB Bostik up in Nuristan, there was a ground movement that would resupply FOB Bostik one or two times a month. And that was always a pretty significant operation. The enemy would try and disrupt the supply convoy along the whole way, and we essentially secured it. So, you know, I'm coming into Afghanistan. My Iraq deployment was not super, super kinetic, although I did get, you know, a ton of time going on patrols and stuff under my belt, so I knew what things were like, but really not in a lot of huge firefights or anything like that. So really our first week in Afghanistan, you know, is the supply run up to FOB Bostik. So we had not even connected our relief in place yet with the, you know, 173rd Airborne Brigade that we were swapping out with. So, you know, had my platoon with some 173rd guys securing part of our route up to FOB Bostik. And, you know, we're driving up and the convoy is out of sight. And the other platoon that was with us from Alpha Company called later asking for some help because the road was blocked. And two jingle trucks had broken down, two civilian supply trucks had broken down. They were crashed together on this one lane road and set on fire by the Taliban to essentially fix this other platoon in place so they couldn't, you know, return to base. And so my platoon drove up to go help them to figure out what was going on. And I got out of the truck along with one of my squad leaders, Sergeant Brent Schneider, and Sergeant Randy Sellers, my RTO. And we walk up to see what's going on, and we're immediately kind of hit with PKM fire all around us. Thankfully, you know, none of us got shot at the time. I took like a ricochet or a rock to the back of the head and kind of cut my head open a little bit. But, I mean, it was like game on. So it was a very interesting way to start the deployment, as well as, again, them testing us as soon as we first showed up, really. They saw a new patch and they were ready to kind of test us.
Well, you know, I think it sounds like that really sort of set the tone for that deployment. It was going to be a fight. The story that I asked you to share on this episode comes from kind of the tail end of the deployment, but I think it's important for listeners to know, to have a little bit of context, that you were wounded pretty severely in the middle of the deployment. You were shot in the head. I wonder if you can just tell kind of briefly what happened.
Sure. So we were doing, you know, baton air assault, air insertion, and it was this valley to the north the Gaki Valley or Morawara, just north of Five Joyce away. It's really kind of across the river from Asadabad, the provincial capital, right, of Kunar province. So I got intelligence that there was enemy massing in the village, specifically in the village of, or in the valley, specifically in the village of Dardam. So our battalion set up, you know, battalion air assault, as well as a company kind of driving up the middle of the valley to go ahead and clear the village of Dardam. I had reports there were somewhere, you know, on the order of 200 or 300 fighters, which was kind of a standard number for these larger deliberate operations that we would do. And I was the recon platoon leader, as I described before. We got inserted first, dropped off at the wrong HLZ. We walked about 3 kilometers with 300 pound Gedcos, kind of, you know, walking through the land before time. I think the elevation was somewhere around, you know, 7,000 feet, carrying these Gedcos through the mountains, you know, set up a small observation post overwatching Dardam. And, the sun comes up. We kind of got in right as the sun was coming up, and, the deliberate operation starts, you know, the decisive operation starts driving down the valley. And my platoon was pretty much surrounded. We were the most eastern element, so the element that was furthest in the valley. We got attacked from something like 9 positions from essentially, you know, 270 degrees around us. Accurate marksmen, PKM fire. They're trying to lob RPGs up at us too. Guys maneuvering to try and get as close as they could. I ended up getting shot in the head. And I fell off the narrow ridgeline that we were on. I was unconscious for about 30 minutes or so, and then was fortunate. I was able to, I woke up, crawled away to a tree. My platoon was still in contact the whole time. I know we had some radio scanners with us, and the Taliban were talking about trying to come grab me when it got dark. And thankfully, about 3 hours after I was shot, we had PJs come on station and get lowered down to pick me up. To their credit, they were in direct fire contact with the enemy the entire time that they were lowered the PJ down. A guy named Josh Webster got lowered down to come grab me and pick me up and then take me back to first, you know, the surgical team in Asadabad, where they kind of cleaned my wounds. I ended up... a lot of my scalp was kind of falling off my head, but I had 50 sutures and staples to put my scalp back together. Had a brain injury. When I fell off the ridgeline, I rolled down the side for about 300 meters. I fractured 4 vertebrae in my back, broke my leg, tore my labrum the top and the back. So kind of a lot of things happened, I guess, John. But, you know, thankfully I went back to Fort Campbell, you know, received some really great medical treatment there. And then was able to finagle my way into redeploying on the same deployment back to Afghanistan.
Well, you know, to be wounded that seriously, get sent back to the U.S., recover sufficiently to then deploy again, rejoin your unit in Afghanistan is, to be honest, it's crazy. And you know, we're gonna get to. This sort of story that I asked you to share. So I almost feel bad glossing over this one, which in and of itself would, I think, make an exceptional episode of The Spear. But when did you get back into Afghanistan?
So, you know, I got shot June 27, 2010. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Staff Sergeant Eric Shaw was killed that day. He was actually one of my squad leaders on my Iraq deployment. We were pretty close. He was posthumously awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for carrying some Americans and some wounded Afghan soldiers to safety before ultimately, you know, being killed. And then Sergeant Thomas from our Bravo company as well was killed during the operation. But so yeah, it took about 5 months of recovery to get back. I was very, very focused and kind of obsessed about going back to Afghanistan because I knew I had some time. The doctors kind of laughed when I said that I wanted to go back, but it was something that I wanted to do. It was honestly pretty hard. So, you know, I'm on rear detachment. Like I said before, almost the whole division was gone. The whole brigade was gone. So, you know, I didn't really have any friends back, right? So I'm sitting on kind of rear detachment, healing up, getting better. And you know, the pace did not slow down in country. So we had a lot of guys get wounded and a lot of guys get killed even after, you know, I was injured. So it was kind of, it was very frustrating to me being on rear detachment, healing up, getting better, and just watching these memorial ceremonies come through, you know, all the time, these Eagle Remembrance ceremonies for guys that were killed in country. And I'm just kind of hanging out in rear detachment. So, I was pretty focused on getting better. I would, looking back, I kind of rushed things, but I was able to get back in country before Christmas of 2010. So just really five and a half months later, I was able to get back in country and kind of show up. My battalion commander, who's now General JB Val, wasn't really sure, you know, what to make of me. I was the night shift top guy for about 2 weeks before one of the company commanders talked to him, and I was made a platoon leader again, this time in HHC. So we had kind of a unique task organization in country at the time. Our headquarters company actually had three rifle platoons assigned to it. So it's not a normal kind of MTO, normal organization, but in this case, we had three rifle platoons assigned to HHC when we were in Kunar in Afghanistan.
Okay, so let's jump forward to the story you're going to tell from Operation Strong Eagle 3. You know, some listeners that might sound familiar to, because we had several months ago an episode with a guy named Jason Pomeroy who shared a story from this same operation. I know you know him. He was also a platoon leader in a different company within the battalion. And I think something that's really important to point out is that, you know, if this was World War One or World War Two, a battalion might occupy a section of the front lines that are, you know, at maximum a couple hundred or a few hundred meters wide. In Afghanistan, that was very different. A battalion could own a lot of battle space. I wonder if you can just kind of spatially describe what this operation looked like. As I understand it, you were in one valley and he was in a parallel valley?
That's right. So this operation, Strong Eagle 3, took place honestly, just about a kilometer or two from the border with Pakistan. He was going to objective, I think it was Sarbaroi Calais. I was going to objective called, or the town called Barwalo Calais, just north of that. So it's kind of funny. I grew up in Charlie Company, which is Jason's company that he was in. You know, I knew the NCOs there very well because, like I said, I was on the Iraq deployment before and had been the company XO for a little bit. But so I knew everybody quite well. So just to kind of bring everybody in for time. So this was March 2011. So we are, I mean, some of our soldiers were about 2 weeks or even a little less than 2 weeks out from redeploying, getting on a plane to go home at this point. So it was, you know, not necessarily an ideal time to conduct this operation, but we're essentially, so kind of, I guess, zooming out a little bit. When we first showed up to Afghanistan, you know, we were in these huge firefights, right? We did this Operation Strong Eagle 1 where we had two guys get killed, I think over 10 guys get wounded, you know, to include myself. And we kind of felt like, you know, we were going to be replaced by the 25th Infantry Division, a brigade out of there, 3rd Brigade. And we were kind of hoping to buy some space and time for them when they flew into country, right? So we're conducting Strong Eagle 3 in late March 2011, kind of the lead up to the fighting season. Part of the thought process was that we could disrupt QZR, who's kind of the head insurgent leader for Kunar province. The objective I went to was actually his hometown where he grew up. If we could disrupt the insurgent network in late March into April 2011, that would buy some time for the 25th ID, you know, 3rd Brigade to kind of learn the AO a little bit before they had insurgents kind of massing on their flanks, if you will, at each of their COPs, right, and testing them. So the timing was probably ideal in that we would buy time and space for a 25th ID, but probably not, you know, ideal in that, you know, soldiers are looking forward to going home and not looking forward to doing this very large battalion operation right before they fly home. So Charlie Company was on the southernmost objective in a valley. There was a ridgeline between us where there was Bravo Company and the Scouts. And then I was in the valley just on the north side of that ridgeline there with headquarters company.
So you got a company on a ridgeline and then one on either on the valley on either side.
Correct. And then we actually had our Alpha company as well, a few kilometers to the north. So kind of, you know, at the battalion level, the mission analysis conducted showed that, you know, there was a platoon or two of enemy fighters that would take, you know, 12 to 24 hours to reinforce the enemy in the valleys that Jason and I were at. So they stuck our Alpha company a few kilometers to the north, kind of on the planned infiltration route of the enemy to go ahead and disrupt any reinforcements. So like the thought process was to try and, you know, isolate the problems that we had in these two valleys. Again, I think the enemy assessment going into things was 200 to 300 fighters spread across both valleys there. And essentially what these two valleys function as is kind of like a home base. And I know Jason's objective kind of ended up being like, you know, I guess for the military listeners, it's almost like a 30th AG, like a reception, right? Like you show up, they had, you know, quite a bit of material and equipment there. My objective had a lot of ammunition and rounds. I know Jason's objective had a lot of ammunition as well, but also like, hey, welcome to the Taliban. You know, here's your chest rack. Here's your AK. Here's some mags, right? I know we had like tons of sleeping bags on my objective, recoilless rifle rounds, mortar rounds, RPG rounds, stuff like that. So it was to an extent a safe haven because we never went that deep into these valleys, like ever. And it was also kind of like a transit point, I guess. You know, like once you cross from Pakistan into Afghanistan, this kind of area was it seemed like a lot of times their first stop that they would make and kind of arm themselves and then move out from there.
Okay, so what was the mission that you briefed to your platoon?
So I briefed that we were going to kind of clear Barawala Calais, really to disrupt the insurgent network in Kunar province. So again, the kind of the macro thought process was to buy some space and time for the unit replacing us so that they didn't really have like their own stronghold one, right? Like they had some kind of more time to figure things out. So really just brief my guys that we're going to go down and clear Barwell Calais. My platoon was the decisive operation, right? For the clearance and kind of much like, Jason's company's plan, right? So we had three platoons with us. We were gonna have one platoon, a second platoon led by, John Ferris, stay on top of the mountain to secure the high ground. So we kind of figured out through all these operations that if you didn't own the high ground, you're going to be in bad shape. So we left a platoon on the high ground, kind of where we landed at this HLZ at like, you know, something like 8 or 9,000 feet. And then my platoon, which was third platoon, and Greg Hom in first platoon, the two of us would kind of lead the clearance of this valley. And we would essentially, you know, leapfrog these little sets of kolots, these mud homes and these little village clusters and kind of clear our way through the whole valley of all insurgents. And, you know, we assumed we would find some weapons and arms and stuff like that as well. So we'd destroy those. So for much like Jason, you know, for this operation, we had dogs were a part of it. We had EOD with us. We had a PSYOPS team with speakers to play messages. You know, we had a lot of enablers with us to kind of assist us with this clearance operation.
How long was the operation supposed to take?
So it was planned for 3 days. It ended up being closer to 10 days overall. But yeah, we were pretty confident that we could clear all the village clusters and the areas around them in about 3 days. But it ended up taking longer than that.
Did you meet pretty stiff resistance early on?
So not right away. So it was interesting. You know, we landed, period of darkness, get off the helicopters, set up security, right? The whole company, you know, landed over time. I was up on, you know, different radio nets. We heard a broken transmission on the battalion net about casualties on Charlie Company's objective. So if you listen to Jason's story, it wasn't his platoon. It was a different platoon. Ran into a significant amount of contact, really just kind of right off their drop zone. They ran into a few guys that were hiding in the trees and ended up getting in a firefight where some U.S. soldiers were ultimately killed there. So we heard like a broken transmission about that. I shared that with my team, with my platoon, to make sure they're aware that there's obviously enemy in the area. But, you know, when stuff like that happens to another company on a mission, you hear it, you acknowledge it, you put it out to your team so everyone's aware, but you're really focused on what you're going to do, right? So we kind of, we kept it in the back of our minds just as a warning, but we didn't dwell on it. We just kind of moved out to get ready to start the mission.
So when did your platoon first make contact?
So it was kind of interesting. So we were clearing these village clusters. You know, we walked down from the HLZ down, you know, like 1,000 feet or so to get down to these village clusters and started clearing them. There were
still at night, still dark.
So we started at night, but it ended up transitioning to day. So we really didn't make contact for probably the first, you know, 12 hours of the operation or so. We walked down, start clearing things. We had a lot of assets on station. So we had fixed wing jets, right? We had helicopters on station. Kind of as daylight came, they saw a lot of women and children leaving the area. So what we found out in this area is that if women and children were walking out of the valley, that was typically a sign that things were going to get very, very kinetic, very lethal, big firefight coming up. But, you know, as the sun came up and kind of started getting lighter, there was really no contact on our objective. Things were pretty quiet. There were a few women and children that stayed back in a few of the homes. They said that, you know, all their husbands, their family members were day workers in Jalalabad, which was, you know, a pretty ridiculous story because Jalalabad was a significant distance away and there was no way to drive out of the valley. Just kind of a fanciful story. So there were no men in any of these homes, right? So it's a weird feeling kind of getting into this. And then I want to say it was sometime around noonish. The weather got bad, right? The cloud ceilings dropped, visibility got a lot worse. And essentially all the supporting assets we had, the fixed wing aircraft and the rotary wing helicopters had to go off station because of the weather. So probably about 10 minutes after the weather rolled in, the assets went off station. They left us, because they couldn't see anything. They couldn't fly. The risk to them was too high. And sure. About 10 minutes after that, I remember standing, you know, outside of a Kalat. I heard a couple loud booms, which sounded like the Barrett going with the scouts, and then some more small arms going. It sounded like BCO on the ridgeline, and then just kind of our valley really erupted with fire, kind of all at the same time. So, you know, rounds started coming pretty close to machine gun rounds started coming pretty close to the clot that I was in. And so at this time, to kind of, I guess, set the stage a little bit, my platoon was spread a little bit. So we had kind of we broke down into two sections, essentially a lead section, led by, at the time, Staff Sergeant, Offer and Arachaga, and then a trail section with my weapons squad leader, and also my acting platoon sergeant, Kellis Richardson. So the idea was that, you know, the lead section would move while under cover of our, you know, machine guns. They would get set, and then the trail element would essentially collapse down on them, and we just kind of bound like that, you know, bounding overwatch just to make sure that we were as safe as possible.
So now that things have sort of kicked off, did you have a sense where the incoming fire was coming from?
No, it was really disorienting because it felt like it was coming from everywhere. So it was coming from across the valley. It was coming from four of us in lower elevation. And it felt like there's some rounds coming from really our rear kind of up the mountain. It was very confusing at first. And as things kind of progressed, you know, we're in a firefight. I was with the trail section at the time because I was taking an inventory with the EOD guys of all the munitions that we were finding on the objective, right? So we're finding tons of Recoilless rifle rounds, tons of RPG rounds, tons of mortar rounds, you know, ammunition, all these different things. And I heard a broken radio transmission on my platoon net stating that they had a couple casualties. And so, you know, trying to gather more information while also balancing, you know, letting the situation develop a little bit. You know, if my lead section took some casualties, we'll let them handle things, make sure that they, you know, win the 10-second gunfight, right? So win the initial contact in order to kind of set conditions so they can call up and feed me in on the situation. Right. So essentially what happened was the lead section was moving forward with some ANA counterparts. As the weather came in, it actually started to rain, right? And the ANA with my lead section dropped their rucksacks and pulled out their cold weather gear to put on so they didn't get wet. Sergeant Arachaga, again, the leader with the lead section there, kind of ran forward and was yelling at them to pick up their rucks and keep moving. And once they cleared the Kolos, they could put on their rain gear. And kind of that's really when the main volley of fire started. So unbeknownst to me at the time, the Afghans and my lead section were crossing a draw, and Sergeant Arachaga ran forward and was yelling at them. And the enemy, you know, obviously was looking for a leader and, you know, let the initial volley of PKM fire go and, shot Sergeant Arachaga in the lower back, kind of just below his body armor plate. Sergeant Trim, one of my team leaders, ran forward when he saw what happened, grabbed Sergeant Arachaga by his body armor and kind of began dragging him back to cover. Sergeant Trim, he got shot actually in his forearm while he was pulling Arachaga back. Dude was a stud, just switches hands, grabs Arachaga's body armor with his non-injured arm and pulls him back to cover. So I'm with the trail section, you know, with my weapons squad leader. And Sergeant Arachaga, he had just been shot, or my teammates had just been shot with the lead section. And we're talking back and forth about the situation. So we end up, we decided, like, you know, move to their location, right? So there was still a pretty high volume of fire going on. So the enemy was engaging, you know, the known position. So even though we all took cover, they couldn't see us. They're still suppressing our location. We were shooting back. Obviously, it was still hard to identify where they were at. Just they didn't really use tracers, so you could really only see muzzle flashes. So it was hard to determine where the enemy was, and they were also very well dug in. They had a defense planned, and so we and me and my RTO. So like, hey, Kalen, his name is Kalen Waite, so I called him KWOW, was his nickname. So like, hey, KWOW, we're gonna go right over here, link up with the machine guns, and then we're gonna go help out. And we ran out of the clot. It was, you know, very steep, kind of running uphill, shale rock again. So we kind of scrambled on our hands and our feet, and we're getting shot at in the process. And, you know, I got up higher to where I could take cover for a second, and then kind of ran down this muddy dirt path to where the machine guns were to kind of link up with everybody there. Sergeant Richardson had already run down with our medic and another NCO to go help Arachaga and Sergeant Trim, who are still receiving effective PKM fire and RPG fire.
And you still don't know exactly where that fire is coming from, or is the picture starting to become a little bit clearer?
So at this point, we were taking fire from across the valley to our south, taking fire below us in elevation, relatively close by to the south, taking machine gun fire from the west, and then to our north, uphill, we were also being engaged and suppressed by enemy and machine gun fire from there as well. So,
wow. So
more or less three different directions. So really, the only place we weren't getting shot at from was off to my east, where First Platoon was, and they were in a very, very similar situation. They had a couple casualties where they were at, and they were also in a pretty significant gunfight with the enemy who were around them. So kind of bring us back to Third Platoon, you know, where I was. I linked up with Sergeant Barley, one of my guys with the machine guns, and was talking with Sergeant Richardson, who was with the two wounded soldiers that we had. And they were not in a good place. They were the guys that were there in the initial gunfight or had shot a lot of ammunition were kind of running low. The guys that went to reinforce them brought some additional ammunition with them to kind of help out, but they were not in a good spot, and had two casualties, right? So we called up the 9-line for these guys, and kind of over time we kept taking more casualties, and I had, you know, my battle roster numbers. I was just like taking names off this list, and it was just really disheartening at the time, John. It was like, I'm checking this list off. It's like almost all my NCOs, right? So, you know, Sergeant Trim is shot, Aaron Chaga shot, Sergeant Richardson took shrapnel from an RPG, you know, Sergeant Sizemore took shrapnel from an RPG and Spall from machine gun rounds hitting like right in front of his face. You know, I'm like, oh shit, like going through this list, and I really didn't have a whole lot of NCOs who weren't, you know, injured in some way.
How much time has passed by this point since you first took contact?
This is probably about an hour or so now. Okay. And so my medic ran down there as well, a guy named Jameson Linsgog. Jameson ran down there, checked on Irachaga, checked on Trim. So at the time, Sergeant Trim basically told my medic to go away. He was fine, and you know, was launching 40 millimeter HE rounds at the enemy troop on the line and just trying to keep everybody motivated at the time. Kid was killing it, right? Crushing it. He goes to check Arachaga. His wounds are dressed well. And then, you know, also some Afghan casualties. So my medic went and treated these Afghan casualties as well. One of my team leaders, a guy named Sergeant Mendez, was treating an Afghan soldier when he took two PKM rounds to the chest. Thankfully, his body armor stopped both machine gun rounds, and he was okay. Obviously, bruised. He sat up immediately after getting shot and then returned fire. So my medic, Specialist Linsgog, ran and essentially sat right where Sergeant Mendez got shot and continued to work on this Afghan who had a couple gunshot wounds and was injured. Jameson was continued to work on this wounded Afghan soldier until he was shot, by a PKM round, really right above his side body armor plate, kind of in his armpit. So he was shot. There was no exit wound. So again, this is about an hour in. So kind of review where we're at. Sergeant Arachaga was shot in the lower back by a PKM, no exit wound. Sergeant Trim was shot in the arm, kind of the forearm through and through. He's okay. My medic, Specialist Linsgog, was shot just really in his armpit with no exit wound. And I had Sizemore and Richardson both with shrapnel in their body. So it was definitely not a good situation at all. That element was not real mobile. And, you know, we had called up in Highline and kind of continued to update as we took additional casualties.
You mentioned that the weather had gotten bad and that the aerial assets had all had to leave the area. How concerned were you when you're calling in these nine lines that it might be difficult to get a medevac bird into you?
I definitely had some concerns. But one of the things our battalion always did is whenever we did these big operations, we always requested PJs to forward stage, right? So I knew that we had two HH-60s out of Fob Joyce, which was a 5-minute flight away, with PJs just sitting and waiting for the call. So I knew that there were some casualties on the other objective. They had flown there, I guess, and helped them out. So what I didn't realize at the time was that I think one PJ bird already had taken rounds and couldn't fly anymore. So the second PJ bird was actually infilling to our location when it also began to take rounds. So essentially this PJ bird, you know, flies in, we see it come to a hover. It was a single ship, which is unusual for them. They usually fly in two ship, but the other bird had taken rounds and was, you know, not mission capable anymore. So a single ship, we see, I'm watching this PJ stands, at the door of the aircraft. He's about to kind of begin to lower himself down to us. And the aircraft just gets raked with PKM fire. So it was definitely a low moment seeing this medevac aircraft show up on station, get hit with PKM fire, and then fly away without our casualties. You know, because we have guys that you know, their status is declining.
It's the golden hour, right? I mean,
the golden hour. You're right, John. Yeah. And we're not making it. So before the aircraft arrived, Specialist Linsgog, my medic, he fought for probably about 30 minutes before he passed. But he told one of my squad leaders, Sergeant Sizemore, that he couldn't fight anymore, and that he was sorry, and he died. So, you know, we've got one US KA, my medic, who's dead at this point, right? And several other casualties. And so we're definitely not sitting in a good place. And just the morale drop across the entire platoon, you know, when the one medevac aircraft that finally shows up, flies away, was pretty disheartening, obviously. Fortunately, a little while later, we had just big Army medevac come in. Thankfully, the situation at that time, it was probably, I don't know, 30 or 45. It's hard to remember exactly because so much was going on, and time kind of feels like the pace changes, you know, when it happens. But big Army medevac shows up later and picks everybody up. So Sergeant Arachaga is alive. Sergeant Trim is alive. Sizemore and Richardson, the guys from Shrapnel, decide to stay. They don't want to leave. Sergeant Mendez, who, you know, took two rounds to his front plate, he's okay. He wants to stay too. So, you know, I was thankful to be surrounded by these phenomenal non-commissioned officers and soldiers who decided to stick it out. Sergeant Trim actually tried to stay. Had the medic was begging him to leave with them, you know, because he had a gunshot wound to his arm. But he finally agreed to leave. I think they left and they actually came back a second time because we, you know, Specialist Linskog was killed, and, you know, carrying the remains of one of your fallen teammates, you know, in the mountains is a pretty brutal endeavor just to move a body like that. And so we were able to get them to come back and pick up his remains as well. Might have been the same when they picked up the wounded as well, but it was tough because, you know, we had a bunch of guys that were hurt, guys were wore out, and, you know, we were able to get his remains out, thankfully. But it was a pretty brutal situation. Thankfully the weather got better. We ended up dropping a lot of bombs, suppressing a lot of enemy positions, and killing a lot of enemy with attack weapons team and scout weapons teams, right? So Apaches and Kiowas came back on station, and we just, you know, kind of engaged all known, likely suspected positions, and we were able to kind of change the tide of the battle for that first day of what ended up being 9 or 10. And kind of my element collapsed back. We reunited and, you know, kind of connected a strong point defense in some abandoned collots there, and that kind of ended the first day.
Ended, you know, what was clearly a really tough day, a long day of hard fighting, you know, especially given your medic had unfortunately been killed. You had a couple of guys wounded and medevaced out, another couple of guys who were wounded but stayed there on the ground. Can you talk a little bit about what you kind of perceived your role to be as a small unit leader on a day like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of saw my role at that time as a small unit leader is right. So you are, as a platoon leader, you're the link to your higher headquarters, right? To your company, your battalion, and your ability to paint the picture for your commanders, right? At echelon kind of helps your platoon, helps your soldiers get what they need, right? So, you know, throughout this whole time, I was talking to my company commander, who was actually on the objective with us, telling him what was going on. You know, it's also a balance, right? So first platoon, who was also in our valley, had casualties. You know, remembering Jason, right, in Charlie Company, and the other objective, was also in contact at the same time. Bravo Company on the ridgeline between us was in contact at the same time. So if you can imagine, you know, we had artillery that could support us. We had fast movers. We had, fast movers, fixed wing jets. We had helicopters. But when you have the entire battalion, right? So you had, you know, three companies, Charlie Company under the valley to the south, Bravo Company and the scouts on the ridgeline, and HHC in the northern valley, all competing for assets, all taking casualties, all in these huge firefights at the same time. You know, the number of assets you have becomes quickly limited, right? Across, you know, these essentially three companies that need help at the same time. So platoon leader needs to A, you know, talk higher, paint the picture to fight for those assets. B, understand the bigger picture that you may not get what you need right away. And C, like John, kind of one of the things I learned is part of leadership is presence, right? Just being there with a guy, sharing the hardship, sharing the risk is an important piece, right? And so when if your soldiers trust you, they know you, they're happy to see you there. And it's part of it is keeping a steady hand, right? Staying calm, talking calmly and slowly on the radio brings a lot of clarity and does bring, some level of peace to the situation and kind of calm things down a little bit.
Okay. So you've now collapsed your platoon back, consolidated at these empty collats. It's the end of day one. You're kind of winding down from a tough fight that day. Also starting to prepare for, the next day and the day after that, because this is going to be a multi-day mission. What's kind of going through your head that evening?
Just making sure that everybody's okay, talking with my NCOs to see where everybody's head's at. They were all solid, just making sure the soldiers understood what was happening and could kind of deal with what was there, what was going on. I was actually fortunate that the battalion chaplain was with us. So he was able to talk to guys and he and his chaplain assistant kind of made some jokes and stuff to kind of try and bring some relief to the situation. Everybody was pretty worried. Everybody was pretty nervous. Unfortunately, most of the soldiers had been in somewhat similar situations in the past, so they were kind of used to it. Stress inoculated a little bit is kind of the way Jason put it in his podcast. But yeah, it was challenging. It was, I'm not gonna say it was easy at all, John, but everybody knew that, there's only one way out, right? And that was, the end of the valley to the exfil point. So, everybody kind of did their best to keep their head in the game.
So we're going to jump forward to day three. Was there anything that happened though on the second day?
The second day we were in firefights off and on, but we were strong pointed, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But the third day we were going to move to the third set of collats. So we did this during the daytime. The terrain was super, super nasty. And we had some incidents of guys moving at night where they would fall and just start tumbling and not stop. Thankfully, the worst situation, we actually, another soldier caught the guy that was falling down the side of the mountain and stopped him, but it was extremely steep. So we ended up conducting a lot of these operations during the daytime, just because it was easier for us to maneuver to an extent. But we also assumed risk by doing during the day and having the enemy watching as well, although they were still active at night. So day three, we're moving to a set of collats during the day. And before we started, my lead team leader, Sergeant Z, was like, "Sir, I don't want to lead the way because I don't want to get anybody else killed." So, kind of to your point before, everybody was kind of on edge and pretty nervous about things. But I said, "Hey, Sergeant Z, we got to keep moving. I'll come with you. No big deal." And we moved out. So it was, again, the same kind of concept. We had one section with the machine guns, strong pointed at the collats, that were overwatching the movement of the lead section, moving to the next set. I was moving just behind the lead fire team. And we got probably halfway, so probably, the distance between the collats were probably 400 meters. We made it probably about 150 or 200 meters, and then the valley just erupted in fire again. It was really disorienting being down the side of the mountain, kind of behind the lead fire team, because I had a set of peltors on. I was looking around. I was super confused because it sounded like it was coming from everywhere, and it essentially was. It's funny because like PKMs make a different sound, right? Like a higher pitch than standard machine guns. So I heard all this PKM fire at first, and I was like, okay, like it's not so bad. Like it's like relatively effective on us moving. But they're also shooting at the guy strong pointed, so that's okay. But some of the PKM is also the Afghans with us. And then I quickly realized that the Afghans with us had 240s, right? So they had US weapon systems, not AKs and PKMs. So all that fire was actually enemy fire. I thought, oh shit, this is not the best situation, but we gotta keep pushing. So Sergeant Z was ahead of me, and when we made contact, he kind of bounded forward a little bit, and I couldn't see exactly where he was at. And bottom line, they kept moving, we kept moving, and then they found themselves at the very bottom of the valley. They had like missed the set of collats, unfortunately by like 30 or 40 meters, and just went down. And they were basically pinned down. There were guys higher in elevation above them that were shooting down on them with PKMs. There were some guys down the low ground with them. They actually threw a hand grenade and killed, you know, one or two insurgents because they were literally that close to them, and they were asking for help. So I was trying to talk to them on the radio. We were behind that, using this big rock for cover. And I remember he's sitting on this ledge, and I was talking with Sergeant Z and tell him that we're about to move. And I just think in my head, like, man, like, I really don't want to go back to the hospital again and get shot. Like, that was not fun, not a great experience. And just kind of sighed and got up and started running down the side of the mountain to kind of get to a position where we could be better see the enemy and better suppress him so they could kind of disengage and move to the Kalats. So it's kind of interesting. I had me and my RTO and my FO, and also the chaplain was with me that day and the chaplain's assistant. So kind of a motley crew running down to help this lead fire team that was in contact that day. We ran down there, suppressed the enemy positions, which allowed that first fire team to enter the Kalats and kind of establish a foothold. And then the rest of the section flowed down. Sergeant Sizemore was with me that day, and we ended up clearing the Kalats and strong pointing again. The weather throughout this whole 10-day operation was nuts. It was like super clear, beautiful blue skies. You know, you're in the mountains, this kind of picturesque environment where there's people, you know, trying to kill you at the same time. Then the weather would come in and it would go from rain to sleet, even to snow. It was nuts. So, you know, the weather got bad for a little bit, got better, and then we just started dropping bombs all over the place. And thankfully suppressed the enemy on day three. We moved forward, successfully secured these Kalats, and then had the rest of the platoon kind of link up with us. And that really kind of was the big end for day three, the kind of enabler of the fire support that we received, the both from helicopters and as well as these fixed wing jets, really kind of broke the enemy's will that day. And that kind of ended the majority of the fight in day three.
Yeah. It strikes me how important something like the weather is, because on day three, when the weather was clear and you could call in air support, you know, it's no longer a fair fight. You know, that's just such a huge advantage for friendly forces. On day one, when you couldn't do that, it seems like it was a pretty evenly matched fight. Did it feel like that?
Absolutely, yeah. There was, again, a significant number of fires in the valley. They knew the terrain very well. They had a lot of dug-in positions that we found, you know, with these, like, six-inch keyholes and stuff spread out. And they were ready for somebody to show up eventually. So it was challenging, like you said, right? You're kind of fighting a fair fight. You know, we have a bunch of U.S. and Afghan soldiers with small arms. We have a bunch of, you know, enemy Taliban also with small arms, except they know where all the defendable terrain is. They know where all their fighting positions are set up, you know, and they're kind of really were ready to go. So it was definitely a challenging fight. And thankfully, you know, with the help of the rotary wing aircraft and the fixed wing aircraft, we were able to kind of win those days and end things. So that was definitely needed.
Well, I really appreciate you telling, I guess, a number of stories, but especially focusing kind of on a couple of days of that one mission, Operation Strong Eagle 3. How many more days total were you out on this operation?
The rest of we spent six more days in that, we spent six total days in that valley. So we had three more days after what I just described. It was a lot of the same, you know, machine gun suppressing while we ran in between village clusters, you know, and then kind of the last day for exfiltration, we had to walk to the other side of the valley to leave. So we, you know, walked downhill at night, crossed what ended up being like a belly button deep river, climbing up the far side up some terraces before we finally left on day six, and we got repositioned to a different valley and spent the last couple days there, so day nine or day 10.
Okay. Can I ask about the guys that you had medevaced who were wounded?
So we found out that after Sergeant Arachaga was medevaced, and he went to the surgical team at Asadabad there, which is you know, ironically, where I was medevac to when I was shot back in June. This would have been March 29th, 2011. He made it through his first surgery, and then unfortunately crashed and died there. So kind of at the end of the day for the platoon, we had two US KIA and something like, I want to say six to eight guys that were wounded as well. Sergeant Trim was seriously injured, but the rest of the guys were more shrapnel and stuff like that. So it was less serious, thankfully.
Good. You know, just from the stories that you've shared, clearly the fighting was intense, and I guess it's fortunate that you didn't have more casualties than I am, of course. You know, sorry for the soldiers that you lost. You know, going back, you said the purpose of this operation was to give a little bit of breathing space for the guys from the brigade from the 25th that were going to be coming in and replacing you. Were there indicators right away that you had been able to achieve that, or did you have a sense that you did accomplish that mission?
I think we did. So I think things in the Kunar River Valley kind of calmed down a little bit. You know, we had kept in contact with some of the guys from the 25th. So our first battalion, right? So I was in 2nd Battalion, 327th, no slack. Our first battalion was in the Pesh River Valley, and then closing it down at the end of their deployment and withdrawing most of the U.S. forces out of there. I know that the 25th came in. I think they did had some breathing space in the Kunar River Valley where we were at, but the Pesh ended up getting real bad again, so they had to put forces back into the Pesh quickly, and I knew they had a really tough series of missions as they pushed back into the Pesh, to include one where First Lieutenant Dimitri Del Castillo was killed. He's a Yuzma grad as well. And I know he died fighting with a hand mic in his hand because they were in contact, calling for help for his guys. So I think we did achieve our end state. And unfortunately, you know, the enemy was disrupted in the Kunar River Valley, and they were able to mass in the Pesh. So I think we made a difference. I think it was important to do. I think we made progress, you know, unfortunately that in a different area nearby, the enemy was able to mass and provide some tough days for the 25th. So I think if we wouldn't have done it, they probably would have had two tough areas they would have had to push into. But I think overall, we did achieve what we set out to do, and it was important. And, you know, the sacrifice that our soldiers made meant something.
Yeah. I think that's a really poignant note. And I think maybe a good one to end on. So Kevin, I just want to thank you again for taking some time and sharing your stories with us.
Absolutely, John. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.